Joining me here today is Simon Hopkins, CEO of Miltrust International. Thank you for being here.
Nice to see you, Abraham.
Before we get started, tell me a little bit about yourself and before you got started in the industry and your career at Miltrust.
Well, I was born in deepest, darkest Staffordshire, rural community. I'd never really been to the city of London until I think I was 13 years of age. I came down to London to see Evita, I think it was. Some years later, I studied law at university, and I was recruited out of law school to come and work in a venerable old house called S.G. Warburg, now part of UBS. And that's really what got me started. I think I pushed a trolley of drinks into the meeting at the university milk round, and I was spotted by somebody. Got chatting to them, and they said, well, we'd like you to come and work in the city. And frankly, I didn't know what that meant at the time, but it proved to be the beginning of a very long journey. I tried to hop off that journey a few times, but every time I took the advice of my wife, she said, nope, you should focus on what you know and get back into the world of finance. And that's what I've tried to do more recently with Miltrust in areas that really interests me. So my focus today is emerging markets. I've always been fascinated on international travel. I've visited many countries, and investing into those markets has given me the opportunity to continue to do that. And of course, today I live in Singapore. It's a very good jumping off point for those markets. And I spend time in China, in India, in Southeast Asia, and of course in Latin America and Africa and other parts of the world which make up that that landscape of the fastest growing developing countries in the world. We do other things, as you probably know. We're involved in agriculture, and we're involved in a very exciting area here in the UK in trying to identify the next generation of talented business leaders driving innovation and science coming out of UK universities. So we are a hotbed of innovation here. We've got tremendous scientific breakthroughs coming out of universities here. We try to spot those and to back those winners and invest into them, invest capital into them for the long term through the British Innovation Fund.
And before you got into all of that, how did you transition from, I read you you sold Fortune Asset Management to Close Brothers back in 2006. What took you from that to getting interested in emerging markets? And what happened there?
When I started out my career at Warburg's, we were involved in selling anything to the international client base of Warburg's, which was one of the leading merchant banks of the day. And that involved me being involved in the Korea Fund, the Burma Fund, some very, very interesting closed-end funds investing into emerging markets. And that triggered my interest in the broader investment landscape beyond Europe, which was my primary focus. I think that career took me through a few years as a broker. As a stockbroker, I joined in the corporate finance department, and they soon found that I wasn't cut out for corporate finance. I'd be better suited to selling equities. So I moved on to the equity sales and research side. And approximately 1996, I set up my first company. And yeah. I left. I was working in Paris for Nomura. Those were the heady days when, as a young man, I felt I could step out and set up my own business with the small bonus I received at the end of my time at Nomura. And I embarked upon building a multi-asset class investment advisory business based on research. And at the time, as good fortune would have it, the hedge fund industry was taking off. And I became a significant investor on behalf of my international clients in hedge funds, building a business, as you mentioned, Fortune, which we were lucky enough to sell before the crisis came in 2007, 2008. So we sold that business in 2007. I worked for Close for a number of years, and then my handcuffs came off and I was able to move to Singapore and set up the new business, Miltrust.
Amazing. So at Miltrust, one of your strategies is to focus on stock selection. Tell me a little bit more about this investment approach and what is the investment approach there?
I think stock selection is part and parcel of the alpha that we're looking to source through a very active approach to investing in emerging markets. So if you think about the developed world, there's a general belief here and a prevailing trend to move towards passive investing, a belief that human beings can't really add an enormous amount of value in investing into developed markets. Emerging markets are very different. This is a landscape of countries that are in different phases of evolution. There's no single emerging market story. They're all in different stages of development. A lot of those markets don't have the breadth and depth that you find in the Western world. And therefore, they're subject to a certain amount of volatility. And that volatility creates opportunity. It creates opportunity through primary research to identify really good companies that are growing fast, that are geared to long-term secular trends like the emerging middle class that is evolving in many of these parts of the world and driving growth. And that's where we're looking for companies. And we do it in a rather unique way. We believe that the best people to uncover these hidden opportunities are people who live and breathe these markets, who are culturally assimilated, who speak the languages, and who live day to day understanding the companies in which they're investing. So if we invest into China, we go to China and we find a good Chinese manager to make those investments. Similarly for Southeast Asia, Latin America, or Sub-Saharan Africa.
Speaking of China, what do you think about popular companies at the moment that dominate emerging markets headlines like Tencent, Alibaba, Taiwan Semiconductor, and how does your approach fit into these companies all around?
These are all great success stories, but in fact, they've become international companies. They're not solely Chinese companies today. A lot of their revenues come from around the world. We prefer domestic themes. If you look at the principal holdings of most of the managers that have exposure to China, whether it's global emerging markets managers or dedicated China managers, the names that you mentioned feature very highly because they're important constituents of the index. We're really looking for companies that are not held by everybody, where we're finding equally exciting growth stories. So we're invested into one of China's largest hotpot companies. You may be familiar from your time in Singapore, sitting around the hot pot. It's a highly social experience, and it's very popular. It's very central to Chinese culture, and it's becoming a high street norm. Shopping malls are growing, and these hot pot businesses are sprouting up everywhere. So we've invested in that business, a company called Ehi. We're also invested into one of the fastest growing goat milk companies in China. Securing high quality milk has been a big challenge in China. There have been a number of scandals in the industry, and people are shifting away from cow's milk, which often people in Asia are intolerant to other forms of milk. And goat milk is a very fast growing segment in that market. So these are consumer stocks. They're very Chinese plays, but they're growing as fast in terms of top-line growth as many of the technology companies you've mentioned, and they're generating real earnings as well. So we're finding some really exciting stories in China. And China has been growing at 10%. It was then growing at 7%. Maybe it'll be growing at 6%. Frankly, it's still the juggernaut, the powerhouse of global growth. And within that huge market today, which represents the second largest equity market in the world, very, very underrepresented in international portfolios, there are a very large number of exciting stories.
And these exciting stories, is that what you mean by domestic leveraged domestically to emerging trends? So how did you stumble upon this, the first company, the hot pot company? They're such a unique opportunity. Like, how do you find companies like this?
We find them through our guys on the ground. So the Miltrust China Fund, in which our global emerging markets fund invested, is run by a team in China. And they are culturally assimilated. They understand what drives Chinese culture and the growth opportunities that you can find within those kinds of themes. And they found the company. And we've been invested in it, and it's been a fantastic performer.
Hmm.
Osnutria, the company I mentioned that is the goat's milk company, equally has been one of our top performing stocks. It features in our global emerging markets portfolio as one of the principal holdings, notwithstanding the fact we're very diversified in that portfolio. But it's a very important holding within a relatively concentrated portfolio of best ideas in China.
Hmm. And what do you think of the highly popular Jack Ma, and how do you deal with perhaps governance risks that might be present in emerging markets and in China in particular?
Who can not be impressed with Jack Ma? I mean, he's an inspiration. He's been an inspiration to a generation, I think, in China. In terms of governance, do you have a particular angle with respect to Alibaba? Are you thinking of something?
In respect to Alibaba, but also just generally, how you deal with how they report financial statements and any issues, if at all, when investing in emerging markets?
I think a few years ago, perhaps 5 or 6 years ago, standards in China in terms of the quality of research, the quality of reporting, the reliability of financial information was much weaker than it is today. Today, there is a huge diaspora of people who've been educated around the world, many of whom are CFAs, highly educated, Chinese, young professionals who've come back and make up a very important part of this newly evolving industry, really. I mean, investment management is a relatively new fangled concept in China, but it's growing immensely rapidly. And it is a Chinese story in itself. As I said to you before, international participation has been relatively modest. It's largely been through the H shares in Hong Kong. We found that access directly to the Chinese markets, the mainland Chinese markets, has been really where the action is. There's still value in Hong Kong, but there are, of course, issues at the moment with respect to Hong Kong as a financial market, given the crackdown that we have seen.
And just talking about some stocks in particular, or if any themes in general, what have been some of your best contrarian calls currently at Miltrust or before in your career?
The greatest good fortune I had was really when I was a broker, recognizing that a move out of one of the mainstream brokerage firms like James Capel, which was part of HSBC, to Nomura, a company that was the third largest market cap company in the world, but in terms of its presence in Asia, in Europe, was relatively unheard of. It was a huge Japanese company, but its presence as a distributor of research and a market participant was relatively modest. And I recognized that if I was going to build a business at Nomura, I would have to focus on people who were not intermediated by investment consultants or subject to the kinds of scales of votes that you typically have that allocate commission revenues. This market has changed immeasurably since those days, but that was the status then. And I shifted my focus to hedge funds. And I started to learn about skill-based investing, the full toolbox that you can use to make investments. That was a very lucky call because it was right at the beginning of the very significant growth phase in hedge fund investing, when the industry went from $200 billion to $3 trillion. And we started out providing research on hedge funds, raising capital for hedge funds, and then investing into hedge funds within the context of broader multi-asset class portfolios. And that gave me the opportunity at a relatively early age to build a business. And I was lucky to sell that business before the financial crisis spoiled the party in 2008. Since then, I've been living in Asia. I've spent nearly 10 years there now. My kids have grown up in Asia, and it's been a very exciting place to be. The sadness I've had is that although the growth in those markets has been very exciting, the markets themselves, the economies have grown, but the markets haven't evolved in the way I would have liked. There's still too little institutional allocation to these markets. there's too few resources focused on finding opportunities in emerging markets. And we've had this post-global financial crisis shift to passive investing. And passive investing means swathes of money come into these markets when they become popular. And as soon as there is any shift in people's perception of risk, money moves out. And that kind of movement of money, that indiscriminate flow of money in and out, does precipitate this problem of volatility. And that makes people shy away. But we believe that it's a place where there is tremendous value. And I still believe that the next decade is going to be driven by growth opportunities in the developing world.
Do you think that this rise in passive investing and the volatility that's emerged, is that not an opportunity for people who are stock picking in emerging markets?
It is an opportunity to differentiate yourself from a very, very large crowd of people who are offering a very mundane proposition for investors. I think investors are the losers, really, in the shift towards passive and ETF investing. It isn't about cost. You can eat well, modestly, in a McDonald's every day. But you're only going to have the minimum acceptable nourishment and the minimum acceptable satisfaction from going to McDonald's. You want to be seeking out the people that are good at cooking and they're consistently delivering. And in the investment management landscape, it's very similar. There's a lot of moderate and unsatisfactory propositions on the high street, but there are a few cordon bleu chefs, and those are the ones that we want to work with.
Why do you think the rise of passive funds has been so popular? And do you think it's doing a service or a disservice to capitalism in general and the democracy of capitalism, so to speak, and the opportunity for individual investors to sort of take control of their own investment decisions or to find and dine at these better restaurants, the way you put it?
I really like the idea of people taking much greater control over their investments. But most people don't have the time to look after their investments professionally. But what they want is an investment journey that is illuminated by information. And I think that's the one thing that's absent from the investment management landscape. People save, they put their money into pension funds. Until the day comes that they want to withdraw that money, they know nothing about the way their money's been invested. But today, people have their PDA in their hand. It's almost like a fifth limb. They're indelibly attached to this, inextricably attached, bound to it. And it is a source of information. So curated information on the investments that you're making that is delivered to you on a daily basis can make the news, can make the information flow that you're digesting every day far more relevant to you because you have a stake in all of these stories. And I think that's the way we'll see the investment management landscape shift. Technology is not a bad thing, but a lot of technology in the fintech world has been developed by people who understand fintech but don't understand the requirements of investment management to meet our long-term investment requirements and to fund what is likely to be a longer and hopefully healthier life, but during which time you need resources.
And speaking of companies that need resources, you also participate in the British Innovation Fund. You also run an agricultural fund. You also have a US-based venture capital fund. Are you interested in smaller companies? And what can you tell me about the stories of the British Innovation Fund and the venture capital fund?
We're very interested in smaller companies because we think that smaller companies in the public equity market space tend to be misunderstood, under-researched, and often a place where you can find really exciting investment opportunities. But we have to be careful about liquidity. In the realm of venture, you have prescribed periods of liquidity during which you can invest. This has become very, very topical, of course, with Woodford, because Woodford had a structure which invested into private investments, and when money was withdrawn, there was a deep concern that those illiquid investments would become a disproportionate portion of the overall portfolio. But he also runs a patient capital trust. Patient capital is conceptually the most sensible way to invest into early stage venture investments, because many of these companies will grow and blossom during the first 5 years of their life, but others will need to be tended and looked after for a longer period, and you don't want to necessarily be pressed into selling them at the wrong time in the investment cycle. So the British Innovation Fund is an open-ended vehicle. It's a vehicle which has some significant local authority pension fund commitments. Those local authority pension fund commitments are long-term. They're committed to the opportunities coming out of UK universities, places of learning, public research bodies here in the UK that we are working with to find the next generation of exciting companies, and hopefully some of those will become unicorns, to use the Silicon Valley terminology.
Hmm. And what can you tell me about the US-based venture capital fund? Is that a really exciting time to be involved there, or do you think the British Innovation Fund is...
I think they're both exciting. Mm. Look, the US is a tremendously innovative country, and money has been flowing into research within universities at a far greater pace than the UK and other universities. It really dwarfs the rest of the world. And that research funding has resulted in tremendous scientific breakthroughs. And out of that, a whole community of companies, largely obviously coming out of Silicon Valley, but there are other pockets of expertise in places like Cambridge, Massachusetts, and of course in other major cities. But we focus very specifically on deep learning, artificial intelligence. We're looking to extrapolate the value of data that is attributable to businesses which are gathering large amounts of data. And they can be in the medical research area, they can be in evaluating dark data in association with the legal profession or the real estate profession. We've got fintech businesses which are assimilating huge sums of data with respect to the banking industry and the asset management industry in a far more proficient way than has ever been possible in the past. We've even got a company that uses computer vision for identifying the quality of fruit and other perishable products from the farm gate all the way through its life cycle to the time it's consumed. And that is something that is unheard of, frankly, until recently. And this is artificial intelligence. So it's driven by the digesting of very, very large amounts of computer imagery.
Some of these companies, these firms that are involved in these highly innovative technologies, sometimes they do, as you mentioned, need funding for 4 or 5 years, where if an investor needs to redeem their money, it's just not going to work. What do you think about smaller companies that are publicly listed and investing in them when in an open-ended scheme where investors may want to redeem their money earlier than usual? As with Woodford, he invested in a lot of smaller companies. Do you think there should be more regulation in this area? And do you think companies that are venture capital companies, are they the only ones who should be allowed to invest in these small companies? What do you think of recent events?
I think it's a question of educating the investor. There are already rafts of rules governing liquidity. So if you're invested into the UCITS framework, any fund that is a UCITS fund has liquidity measured and monitored on a daily basis. So we know 24/7 how long it's going to take to liquidate the portfolio, because there's a regime, there are rules governing the way that money is invested. Investors who want that kind of liquidity profile would invest into a UCITS type fund. If you're investing into an investment trust where the underlying securities may be held for a long period of time, and your exit route is the overall value of that portfolio, the price of the portfolio as opposed to the net asset value of the portfolio, you have a mechanism for discounting the liquidity, the liquidity premium. So if you want to exit, you will take a discount, and that's manifestly represented in the price that the market offers you for your shares. So we have pretty well-defined mechanisms for investing into less liquid, smaller company type investments. And I'm not particularly concerned about changing the rules or making the regulatory environment tougher than it already is.
Okay. One of the things that you also do is run a emerging markets ETF fund where you invest in highly liquid ETFs. What is the strategy there, and how do you implement that?
Some of our clients have adopted the ETF mantra, and they believe that the most efficient way of deploying money into emerging markets, and perhaps the most liquid way, is to use ETFs. And we appreciate that for some types of investors, that will be the best way for them to invest and will tactically be a way that they can move money in and out. It doesn't satisfy my concerns ultimately about the long-term profile of emerging markets, because, of course, providing that sort of liquidity can have damaging effects. But we run an ETF portfolio. We recognize that we were adding about 30 to 40% of the alpha in the portfolio through our quarterly asset allocation. So by using our ability to determine which markets we should be invested in from one period to the next, we're able to deliver through an underlying passive portfolio a real active investment management strategy. It doesn't deliver anything like the active stock picking and the active asset allocation, something we call double alpha, but it does, for those people that want to use ETFs, offer active asset allocation of an ETF portfolio.
What do you think of the quote that Western institutions are still woefully underinvested in emerging markets?
When I set up this business in 2011, we were just coming out of the biggest financial crisis since the crash and the economic malaise of the 1930s. And it was a time when the financial system was really at risk of collapsing. So it's taken a very long time for us to see any real recovery. We have been on a very, very long period of life support, helped by extremely low interest rates and quantitative easing, et cetera, et cetera. During that period, I had hoped that there would be a bifurcation of the trajectory of the markets. Emerging markets, where the growth was still evident, would be strong, and developed markets would be anemic, representing the kind of GDP growth that we see across this total global landscape. The reality is very different. We have seen growth in GDP in the emerging market, but markets themselves have been, unfortunately, relatively weak. If you look back over the life of our emerging markets fund, since June 2012, when we started investing, the MSCI Emerging Market Index is only up about 2% on an annual basis. We've delivered over three times that return, around 7.5%. But it doesn't really make you leap up with excitement to say, I've got annualized returns of 7.5%, given the risks that one takes in emerging markets. Is there likely to be a change? It is really about flows of capital, and it is about confidence. And I think the one thing that we can say after 10 years of malaise, of 10 years of looking for alternative types of investments, real asset investments, income-generating assets, that there will be a return to emerging markets and there will be a normalization of flows. Going back to 1960, emerging markets have delivered overall twice that of the developed world. So there is a long-term theme here, a long-term story. But we've been in rather exceptional circumstances where people have been very, very risk-averse. I think that will be changing.
What do you think of the current market environment where there's extremely low yields from the US government? And how is that affecting emerging markets?
Yields are likely to remain low. I think we're still quite precariously balanced economically in the Western world. And we've seen that in the change in rhetoric from the Federal Reserve. So it is highly unlikely we're going to see a significant increase in rates. And as a consequence, I think there is every possibility that we'll see a weaker dollar. I think that will be very positive for emerging markets. What you have to recognize is that the strength of the US dollar, the corollary to that has been significant weakness in emerging market currencies, many of which over the course of the last 4 or 5 years have halved in value relative to the US dollar. Now, that has created something of a competitive landscape for many of these economies to pull themselves out of this long-term depression. But unfortunately, it has also been a very big destruction of value for international investors. Investors investing in US dollar terms have lost a lot of money in local currency exposure. And the cost of hedging in emerging markets has always been prohibitive because of the interest rate differentials. Now I see that being, reversing. And I think that we'll see as a consequence an opportunity to invest into the value that these emerging market currencies represent and in economies which are still growing pretty fast.
What is your most exciting opportunity that you see out there in the markets today?
Where am I investing my own money? I mean, that is probably the best measure. I'm investing into our emerging markets fund. I'm very excited about the outlook for emerging markets. As I said, both for the trajectory of the markets themselves, the growth, the underlying growth of the economies, a lot of reform-minded governments that have been elected in recent years. We live in the age of the autocrat, but one of the direct corollaries to that is the fact that we have this reform-minded, business-minded environment, which is good for markets. And it's good ultimately for the welfare and success of Asian people, of emerging markets, economies, and the people that live in these economies around the world. And I think that that will be a very evident trend over the course of the next decade. I also think that emerging markets are driving another theme, and that is agriculture. Agricultural land is an undervalued asset, in my view. It's a very exciting long-term theme, and we're coming into a time when commodity prices are weak, and the opportunity to invest into Australia and New Zealand, where there has been a significant currency correction, particularly for investors from this part of the world or the United States, offers very compelling value. We found that investors making those long-term types of investments need income, and through contractually secure contracts with farmers, we've been able to deliver that through a distribution that we make to our investors of around 5.5% a year. And that pays them to take this investment, to make this investment into the long-term appreciation of the land values. The challenge is that restrictions on foreign land ownership down under have now become very tight. So you have to find people who have already found a way to deploy capital into these countries rather than setting up new schemes.
What do you think about sustainable investing and impact investing?
Sustainable investing is really at the heart of everything that we do. We look at companies through the prism of sustainability. The broader concept of ESG has yet to really catch on in Asia. But I think that the way we are investing and working with our investment managers is encouraging, increasing focus on ESG as a standing item in the way they look at companies that they invest into. And China is a leader in terms of fighting climate change and investing for sustainability. Having been the world's greatest polluter, There is no country on earth that is more focused on combating climate change than China. So the great irony is people don't recognize that, but this is creating a whole new industry and a whole range of opportunities to invest into companies that are coming up with technologies to combat climate change. And that is going to be of significant economic benefit to those countries that adopt these kinds of approaches. So we see it as a great opportunity. Impact investing is a relatively new concept. It's a very fast-growing concept. I think investing money for good is a wonderful theme, but it always needs to be accompanied with economic drivers that will continue to be the incentive for people to deploy capital into these businesses. So we are seeing these themes catching hold. I think they will remain important themes. I recently attended Fund Forum in Copenhagen. I think every single panel at that event was focused on ESG in some shape or form. It's becoming a very important part of the investment management landscape and a narrative, and I think it's very welcome.
And you mentioned that sustainable investing and some of the companies involved are actually one of their focuses are in this trend of sustainability. Is it hard to communicate the fact that what you mentioned about China and some of the companies in the portfolio are just really pegged to this sort of theme?
We have a dedicated initiative, which is a climate impact fund with a focus on investing into not simply Chinese companies, but Asian companies across the whole of Asia, including Southeast Asia. That fund uses a very systematic methodology for ranking companies that are combating climate change or are creating technologies that are designed to address climate change challenges. So we have dedicated programs for people who want to invest into this as an investment theme. And we also have our overall screen that we work with our managers to deploy. We don't micromanage the way investors that are working for us, deploying capital, are sourcing their stocks and picking companies. That is the job of the stock picker. But we do have a pretty important set of protocols and rules that we set out, because every single portfolio is a dedicated Miltrust portfolio. We don't allocate money to third-party funds. We have our own guidelines and our own rules that govern the concentrated investment portfolios that we manage around the world.
Is there anything that's going on at the moment from a macro perspective that worries you the most?
The world has a lot of challenges. Here, I'm a visitor to the UK. I live in Singapore and I've lived there for 10 years. In Singapore, we're watching very closely what's going on in Hong Kong. I see it to some extent as comparable with the dissatisfaction of people here in the UK. People feel marginalized. People who have grown up speaking Cantonese, living in Hong Kong, feel that the opportunities for them are significantly impaired and reduced. And some of the legislative changes and recent triggers that have caused this outpouring of dissatisfaction are pent-up manifestations of deep frustration. These things have to be handled with enormous care. People in Hong Kong look Chinese, and they are Chinese ethnically, but of course they've grown up in a different environment. And they are not used to the notion of their community changing immeasurably in the way that it has been changing and in the way that the world changes through fluidity of movement of people around the world. So this is something we've got to handle very, very carefully. It can very quickly create deep dissatisfaction. And that can manifest itself in ugly ways. So the job of politicians and policymakers has to be very sensitive to these matters. I'm also concerned about the fact that we have a very low birth rate across the Western world, and it includes Singapore, funnily enough. This is a challenge because we have aging populations, and we have less people contributing to the cost of paying for longer lives, people who are living healthier, longer lives, but who will nonetheless require care. And I think we have a massive deficit in the provision of care, both in most countries here in the Western world, but also in Northern Asia, and of course in Singapore, where I live. These are real challenges, and real challenges that, again, policymakers need to address. And they are not problems that can be solved overnight without very substantial subsidies and funding.
Interesting. Do you think that what about the demographics in emerging markets besides Singapore and Northern Asia? Do you think that's a positive for emerging markets there?
Yes, I think there is something called the demographic dividend in other parts of the world where there are fast-growing populations and very significant shifts of people from the countryside, the agrarian lifestyle that people have lived for centuries, coming into the urban lifestyle that we live now predominantly here in the West, is creating challenges, but it's also creating significant opportunities. And from an investor standpoint, that emerging middle class is a very important driver of the way we look at the opportunity in emerging markets, and the outlook for the companies that we're investing into is very much guided by that long-term trend.
And just finally, as a few personal questions, what has been a hard lesson that you've learned since getting involved in fund management?
The hardest lesson that I've learned, look, I haven't lost my faith in fellow humans, but I've had some significant challenges. I've had to wake up to the fact that we had submitted in 2005 through my colleague, when I was running Fortune, the company investing into hedge funds, a dossier with the SEC that was being patently ignored, and that alerted them to the fact that the world's largest hedge fund was a scam. That was the title of the dossier. And I had the unpleasant experience of showing this dossier to many people who had deeply vested interests in a successful outcome for the Bernard Madoff fund, which ultimately turned out to be a huge Ponzi scheme, and where very large numbers of people lost money. We tried to alert people to the fact that we thought that it was a Ponzi scheme, to some extent we were successful. But the lesson that is that couched in the right language and with the right clothing, you can turn something which is fundamentally evil into something which people buy and people lap up and people invest into. And we've got to be very careful, I think, in the investment management world to make sure that we have transparency, honesty, and that you know, the recent lessons which you alluded to about the way portfolios are constructed, and are they suitable for the types of investors that are being encouraged to buy them, is a very important direct consequence of the kinds of lessons that we learned with some degree of rather brutal outcomes in the financial crash of the last decade. And I think, sadly, we tend to forget these lessons very, very quickly. Mm. It's the nature of human beings to be perennially optimistic, but we mustn't forget the lessons of the past.
How did you initially spot or suspect that this was a fraud?
Well, I ran a research business called Global Fund Analysis for a number of years, and our work was to go and evaluate investment managers, to look at them in terms of the personalities running the business, to look at their risk management, to look at their investment process, and ultimately to look at the performance of the funds and to rank and rate managers on that basis. And we sold that service around the world in 24 countries to over 30,000 clients. And so we had a real responsibility to try to weed out those companies that didn't wish to open up to this level of scrutiny. When we became suspicious of the business because of the failure to disclose information to us, that's when some of the professionals within my team decided to start to dig. And through their hard work, with a backdrop of considerable intimidation, they were able to identify things that just simply didn't stack up or about the way that business was being run.
So the initial red flag was the lack of transparency.
Exactly, yes.
Do you think that problem still exists today?
The hedge fund industry is a fraction of the size it was in terms of mainstream investment. I think there was a vast proliferation of managers during the 2000s, the noughties. That number has consolidated into a very small number of very large headline-grabbing names. But those names are largely irrelevant to the wider investing population. It's very difficult to access these managers. There's a very small number of professional investors that are typically invested with these types of managers. Many of them are still extremely secretive. They don't provide information about their activities. And they're not really relevant in the broader democratic investment management landscape, as you put it.
What has been the best book you've read this year?
The best book I've read this year is called The Secret Barrister. And it's an extraordinary story written by somebody whose name we don't know, who has revealed a lot of the failings of the British judicial system, the way it works. It's very entertaining read, and I would strongly recommend it. In terms of the best book I've ever read, I would have to say The Market Wizards, written by Jack Schwager, who was my former business partner. He was the investment director of Fortune when we were investing into hedge funds. And I think the life lessons, as well as the tremendous insights that he provided into some of the greatest traders from a sort of sociological standpoint, what really makes these people tick, what drives them, was a very unique insight for me and a very fascinating way to embark upon my career as an investor, with a focus not simply on the numbers, but also on the people in whom these skills reside.
Well, thank you for that recommendation, and thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Abraham.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it.
Great.